I want you to think for just a second about the things you know to be true, like these. What goes up must come down. Days get longer in the summer and shorter in the winter. The North Star is the brightest star in the night sky, and total solar eclipses are rare. You know what those four things have in common? They're all wrong. All four of those are false statements. How many of you believed at least one of those? Oh, come on, be honest. Most of us, right? So what goes up must come down. Not true. Once you escape Earth's atmosphere or the gravitational pull of the Earth, that we have, you know, Voyager and those things that have left, they're never coming down, right? They're gone. Days get longer in the summer and shorter in the winter. This is the one that threw me. I've said that my whole life, right? What's the longest day of the year? Which is June 21st. What's the first day of summer? June 21st, 22nd. Ergo, every day of summer, the day is getting shorter, actually, not longer. It gets longer and longer up to the point that summer starts. When summer starts, it is then getting longer, and winter is just the opposite. The first day of winter is December 21st. The sun actually, the days get longer as we progress through the winter. The North Star is the 49th brightest star in the sky. If you're looking at the sky and you say, there's a bright star, I'm wishing on it, it's the North Star, you're probably wishing on Venus. Solar eclipses happen about every 2.5 years. They just don't always dissect the United States, so we don't always see them, but about every, nobody says about the Olympics is a rare event. It comes every 4 years. Solar eclipses come every 2.5 years, right? By the way, just so you know, I've already got it on my calendar. Next year, August 21st, there's a solar eclipse. It'll be 96% coverage in central Illinois, and if you go down to the Shawnee and hike like I'm planning to do, you get 100% coverage. So for like 2.5 minutes, it'll be like dark, and birds will start nesting. Have you ever had this experience? There was one when I was in college that was really like that. The last one here in central Illinois was actually on a sunset, so it was eclipsing as the sun was setting, and I'd forgotten it, and the boys were little, and they remember us going out to a field and watching it, and it was eclipsing, and we got, oh, we figured out, because you got to look through smoked glass, and so we figured out that if we got on the other side of our car and looked through the tint of the van, if we looked through the tinted windows of the van, we were like crouched down looking through, it was awesome. So if you don't want to buy smoked glass or sunglasses, you can always use your vehicle as a whatever. The point is that there's things that are that we think are true, and Neil deGrasse Tyson is where I got this list, and he had 10 of them. I was just trying to be in a hurry. There's things that we know to be true, and yet part of life and part of learning and part of growth and part of maturity is often unlearning the things that we know to be true so that we can learn the right thing. And that part of following Jesus, part of faith journey, I think, is always unlearning. And some people get really worked up about this. They get really angsty about, they call it deconstruction or losing my faith or all those things. But maybe the spiritual journey is always one of losing our faith, losing the things that I thought I know, so that I can embrace the things that are really true. Letting go of ideas that, like, the North Star is the brightest star in the night sky, so that I can embrace what's really true, that they're are 48 other stars that are brighter in the night sky. And I think when I study Jesus, and especially passages like the one we're going to talk about this morning, that's what I see in the Gospels, is Jesus is often inviting us to unlearn the things that we're sure we know so that we can embrace Jesus as he really is. That's often the journey for us. Like, for example, Jesus does this all the time in the Gospels. Like, you have heard it said, and then what does Jesus say? But I say unto you. So Jesus might say, you have heard it said that total solar eclipses are rare, but I say unto you. He doesn't say that ever. You can find it in Hezekiah chapter 6. That's what this passage is about. This is a passage where Jesus is turning things on its head. Now, let me give you a little bit of context, and then we'll read from John chapter 12 is where we're at this morning. And I didn't put a slide up or a page number. John chapter 12, verse 20. So last week, if you were here, we worked through Jesus coming in, and we said that this chapter begins the end of Jesus's time here. This is the last week of Jesus. This is the last time we're going to do two sermons, one this morning and one next week, that are his last public sermons. After this, everything Jesus does is personal. It's him talking to his disciples. It's him talking to Pilate. It's him talking to individuals. It's small. This is the last, and actually next week at the end of chapter 12, it's going to, oh, I'll just look at it and read it to you. What it's going to say at the end of chapter 12 is, the end of chapter 36. When he finished speaking, Jesus left and hid himself from them. So there's this sense that it's over. This big public, very public ministry of Jesus is over, and he kind of goes off, and then we get the events of Holy Week. And so where we left off last week is we left off with the triumphal entry, or the Donkey King entry, where he rides in on a donkey and people shout, "Hosanna, save us," and Jesus offers them peace. So let's start at verse 19. John chapter 12, verse 19 says, "So the Pharisees said to one another, 'See, this is getting us nowhere. Look how the whole world has gone after him.'" And then notice the transition to verse 20. "Now there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the festival." Do you see the connection between the two? So in our NIV Bibles, it's a different heading, but this is a really seamless flow that John has going here. John chapter 12, verse 20. "Now there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the festival, and they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. 'Sir,' they said, 'we would like to see Jesus.' And Philip went to tell Andrew. Andrew and Philip, in turn, told Jesus. Jesus replied, 'The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? 'Father, save me from this hour?' No, it was for this very reason I came to this hour. 'Father, glorify your name.' Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and will glorify it again. The crowd that was there and heard it said that it had thundered, and others said an angel had spoken to him. And Jesus said, 'This voice was for your benefit, not mine. Now is the time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world will be driven out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself.' And he said this," John tells us, "to show the kind of death he was going to die. The crowd spoke up, 'We have heard from the law that the Messiah will remain forever. So how can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?' Then Jesus told them, 'You're going to have light just a little while longer. Walk while you have the light before darkness overtakes you. Whoever walks in the dark does not know where they are going. Believe in the light while you have the light, so that you may become children of the light.'" I love that. "When he had finished speaking, Jesus left and hid himself from them." So let's start with observations, notes, questions, anything that stands out to us in these verses. Yeah, there's a really good reason for that. I'm glad you started there. There's a reason why they go to Philip. Anybody have a guess? You may not know this. Philip is a Greek name, as is Andrew. Of all of Jesus' 12 disciples, there's two that have Greek names, Philip and Andrew. And who do the Greeks go to? They get there through their own people. So this is just an interesting aside. Is often the pathway to Jesus, we have to access Jesus through the people we know. The people that you know, their pathway to Jesus is going to be through you, to put a finer point on it. We will respond to people. So, even the note there that Philip was from Bethsaida in Galilee, Bethsaida is a Greek city. And so all of that there is saying, hey, these Greeks, when they came to Jesus, didn't know how to access Jesus except to come to Jesus through the people that they knew. That was their only access to him. And so just this thought to put out in your head, like maybe my friends' only access to Jesus is the one that comes from an invitation from me. That's their only way in. Just a thought. I could preach a whole sermon there. We could do an evangelism explosion. Anything else? Yeah, so Jesus does that twice in this passage where people ask direct questions, and he like apparently answers something else. And we don't know why. We don't know exactly, like, did they get to Jesus and they asked a question that led to the sermon that's going to start in verse 23? Is that what happened? Or was there a conversation and something happened? Or did Jesus just ignore them? I would say it's highly unlikely that Jesus just ignores them. There is something that happens once they get to Jesus that then spawns this sermon. John has in his mind some connection between these two events, and he hasn't, like, filled in the gap, like, what? Like, why did... It'd be like me saying, like, Jeff came over, and then we talked about this, you know, like, without any context for, John's just not giving us that context. Like, how did you all get to talking about that? So, yeah, it is funny. And he does it later when they ask, who is this Son of Man? He never answers the question. He's like, nice question, and then answer something else. I may start doing that. What else? Good observation. Yeah, so this is the third time in the Gospels where a voice comes from heaven. I have a slide. I'll get to those in a minute. Did you want to say anything more about that? It's just weird, right? Like, it's not something we often experience that they heard it thundering from heaven. I want to talk about that in a minute. I'll get there when we work through the passage. I have a slide about the other two times as well. Yes? Wow, that's an interesting thing. So John notes that some people hear a voice and some people hear how does it say it exactly? Let me see. The crowd that was there and heard it said it thunders. Others said an angel had spoken to him. So there's like, there's a longer discussion about this that I'm not going to get into this morning, but that there was this, like, we have to explain this. Something happens supernaturally here, but we have to explain it. Like, I am sure it was just thunder. You know, like we have to have a natural cause for it. And then, like, the next crowd that's a little bit closer is like, no, this was supernatural, but it had to be an angel. Like, they couldn't accept what it actually really was, similar to the baptism. Oh, that this judgment that he talks about down in verse 30 is about the prince of this world and not the people. Interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. That's good. We're going to come back to that because that's a interesting idea there. So you guys both hit on two parts. So this passage is structured in two ways. There's a little, like, he says some things about wheat, and then there's this thing where he does his, what we call John's Gethsemane moment, where, like, should I escape from this? No, this is what I was put here to do. And then he has the light part of it. So there's the wheat part and then the light part. And we're going to work through both of those. So let's start. Verse 23. So Jesus replied, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. There's a Greek word there, eleithen, which means it has arrived. And it's this, this is a little dorky, but it's a future perfect verb, which means that it's completed and it's ongoing. Like, this thing that it's arrived, this final week is here and it's ongoing. So it's this, he senses, at least the way John tells us the story, is that Jesus understands that this is the culmination of everything that's come before. This is the last moment. The comparison is that word tetelestai, which is it is finished, is the same verb tense and the same idea that when Jesus says on the cross, it is finished, it's that same idea, like it's finished, and that finishing has an ongoing repercussion into the future. So what's fun about this, and this is just a little bit of Bible geekery for you, but interesting, is this, it has arrived, are the first words Jesus speaks in John's gospel on Holy Week. He hasn't said anything yet in this passage. This is the first thing that Jesus says, this it has arrived. That's the first thing he says. And the last thing he says in the Passion narrative is what? It is finished. And so those are the bookends for this story, is that the moment has arrived, now the moment is finished. And both of those have an ongoing aspect to them. So that's just neat, I think. So I had to show it to you. I think that at the heart of this sermon then about the wheat, so obviously we understand, I don't need to explain how the example works, do I? Like, we understand the idea of how wheat works, or actually any grass or anything works. Like, for a plant to reproduce itself, it has to die and then scatter its seed so that it can come up a whole lot. At the heart of Christianity then is death. At the heart of the spiritual journey is death. We live in a culture that death makes us feel really uncomfortable, right? Like, and we are trying to get it done faster and faster. Like, the grieving, I was talking to a funeral director not long ago, and like, whereas some cultures grieve for days and weeks, and sometimes even years. Some cultures, you know, like a widow wears black for a year because she's showing her grief. American funerals are getting shorter and shorter, and how can we just get this over with as fast as possible so I can get back to work the next day? And there's just this denial of death that creeps in our culture. And so, but at the heart of Christianity is this idea that we're thinking about death. At the heart of Christianity is that the wheat dies. And so Jesus, I think, is saying two things here. One is he's talking about his own life. That's the no duh. That's the low-hanging fruit. But then at a deeper level, I think that's true for all of us, right? that in order for us to grow, we have to die. Think about it this way. Like, Jennifer and I talk sometimes about what parenting is. It's like, you know, like I long for the days sometimes, like some of you that are young and don't have children, and when church is over, you're going to go out for lunch, and then you're going to have nice quiet naps all afternoon, and whatever you all do with yourselves before you had kids. We all hate you. And we remember that time with fondness, right? Because part of the journey of having children is I have to die to myself and what I want sometimes. I have to die to my desire to sleep in peacefully on a Saturday morning. I have to die to my desire to do the things I want to do when I want to do them. I have to die to my desires sometimes to watch the shows on TV that I want to watch. We're past the stage, but, you know, like some of you, I'm sorry, your life is filled with, you know, I don't even know what the cartoons are now anymore. Blue's Clues was ours, right? That's not the thing anymore. What is it? I love that you all know it, right? At the tip of your tongues, it's just firing off, right? The part of this journey of parenting is this ongoing. I had a friend years ago, and I've told this story many times. He said, like, when I got married, I realized how selfish I was. And that part of being married was I had to die to my own desires because now I am now a we. And so I have to die to my own desires to be a good we to my wife. He's like, then I had kids and I found all new depths of selfishness in me and I had to die to my desires again. This is what Jesus is talking about that is part of the spiritual journey. The spiritual journey is always one where we die so seeds can go in the ground and we can be reborn. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're going to get there in just a second. The idea of hating the family. Yeah, that's fun. That plays well all over America. Let's keep reading. It remains only a single seed, but if it dies, it produces many seed. Anyone who loves their life will lose it, while anyone who hates their life in this world will keep it in eternal life. So Jesus, again, this is this spot. I told you, this passage is about Jesus taking things that we think we know and then turning them on our heads and making us think again, like, oh. And so this metaphor of dying, for me at least, is this idea of, I was talking at Celebrate Recovery the other night, and I was telling them, like, for me, my ongoing spiritual journey is one where I'm always peeling back layers of the onion, right? Like I'm moving closer to Jesus, and I've got to die to myself in this area. And then I get a little further, I'm like, oh, and then I found this other thing. And for those of you that are going to be in my Enneagram Sunday School class, that's the journey of Enneagram, by the way, too, is that you get to this place of, oh, this is who God created me to be. And sometimes our first reaction is like, I'm pretty awesome. And sometimes our reaction is, I'm pretty awful, whatever your reaction is. And then we sit with that for a while, and then we poke at it a little bit further and go, oh, there's another layer here. And the journey is always one of peeling back more layers because people are like onions. Right? As are ogres. That was popular when my kids were little, all right? I'm dating myself. So Jesus then talks about this idea of hating their life in this world. So let me give you a paraphrase, two paraphrases actually. So the message says this one about, obviously Jesus is talking in hyperbole because Jesus doesn't hate his life, and we see Jesus living among people and finding joy and being at parties and all those things. And Jesus isn't asking us to distance ourselves from our life. He's obviously talking hyperbole. And so the message, what it says is this idea that anyone who hangs on to life just as it is, or let me read it to you this way. If one hates the way life is lived in this world in its consummatively selfish way, in our own culpable involvement in that way. So what commentators do here is they say that basically what Jesus is saying is it's not that we just hate life and that we become curmudgeons. That's not what Jesus is saying to us all. It's like, walk out of church today and bah humbug everything in your path. That's not what Jesus is saying for us to do. Jesus is calling us, as we sang the song, the St. Francis song, like, we're supposed to love and we're supposed to be joyful people like that. We're supposed to be moving into the world in loving ways and bringing hope to the hopeless and positively, right? Not hating. But rather, there is this thing in Christianity where we're supposed to question the narratives that the world hands to us, right? That success comes on the back of the poor, that it's always upward mobility, like those kinds of assumptions that our culture hands to us, those are the precise things that are the layers of the onions we're supposed to be peeling away and dying to. that as Americans, we probably ought to at least be suspicious of anything called like the American dream. We at least ought to be suspicious of any narrative that's out there that juxtaposes me against them. That if we really believe this idea that it's going to say later, like when I'm lifted up, I will draw all people to myself, that Jesus is for all people. Like the thing I put up last week with Jesus on the various flags of the world, like most of us are used to seeing pictures of Jesus associated with American flag. But then as soon as I put him on a Confederate flag, like, ugh, that doesn't feel good. Like Jesus is somehow for all people. Those narratives run counter to some of the narratives we're handed to when we're young. And so part of this dying to ourselves is continually putting ourselves in a spot where we're willing to question those narratives and die to my ways of seeing the world, the things I just always have known to be true, and being open to that. Jesus says then, whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. My Father will honor the one who serves me. I love this idea here, and it comes up over and over again in John, and I've said this many, many times, is that Jesus isn't asking us to prescribe to a certain set of beliefs so that we can follow him. Jesus isn't saying, here's the theological statements about me. Do you believe that I, da, 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 da? Rather, what is Jesus saying? What is the mark of a disciple? Two words. Follow me. And so that's where I was saying, like, I want to sit down and do a podcast with Republicans and Democrats and ask that question. How does the way you vote, how does following Jesus reflect in the way you vote? I don't really care who you vote for at the end of the day. I want to hear the link between those two. If you're going to vote for Donald Trump, explain to me how following Jesus leads you to vote for Donald Trump. Explain to me how following Jesus leads you to vote for Hillary Clinton. Explain that to me. Help me understand that pathway for you. Is that awkward? Because I know half the room when I said one or the other, you're like, yeah, explain that one to me too, right? And then the other half was thinking the same thing when I said it the other way, right? And Jesus, I just, that's where, like, when we talk about as a church that we embrace generous orthodoxy, I think that's, to me, that's part of the heart of why we embrace generous orthodoxy, because Jesus isn't saying, like, these are the right beliefs, but rather it's our posture towards following after Jesus. And we recognize that in the history of the church, and in a body as diverse as ours, in a diverse time, in a diverse world, that as we understand Jesus, it's not so much about where we are and we follow Jesus, but our posture towards Jesus. I've drawn this chart sometimes before, up here, where I talk about there's Jesus, and most importantly is like that my arrow is pointed towards Jesus, not necessarily where my arrow is. That my posture is one in which what Jesus says here, follow me, and then he says it even more plainly, like where I am, that's where my servants are. If you're following after me, where I go, that's where you go. My Father will honor the one who serves me. Now my soul is troubled, and this passage is so much like the Gethsemane passages from the other Gospels, verse 27. Now my soul is troubled. The Greek word there is depressed. My soul is depressed. And what will I say? Like, Father, save me from this hour. And then just Jesus saying to himself, like, no, it's for this reason I came to this. I've become convinced in over the years that not only is the pathway of following Jesus one, that death is at the heart of it, but suffering is also at the heart. That if the journey of Jesus towards the cross is this kind of suffering, such that Jesus, who being in his very nature God, was intimidated and scared and fearful of this pathway in front of him, and that his pathway was one of suffering. It wasn't like he was God and so now lashes and crucifixion doesn't hurt anymore. That's not Christian doctrine at all. But rather it was real suffering. And that was Jesus's pathway. And Jesus says to us, follow after me. That anybody that says to us that the Christian life is one that doesn't involve deep levels of suffering, I don't know is talking about the same Jesus of the Gospels that I am. And so stuff like this with Jesus, like, just encourages me, I guess, that in our suffering, whatever our suffering is that this is the pathway of Jesus, and that the goal is not to escape it, and the goal is not to deny it, but rather to embrace it. And not to wallow in it. But I wrote a blog post this week, or last week, I can't remember, but about embracing all of life, right? That life is always joy and it's always suffering and often at the same time. And we hold those two things together. And if I said to you all this morning, give us an account of your life, nearly every one of us could walk up here and stand and say, well, here's some areas in my life that are awesome. And if we were all honest, we could also say, and here's some stuff in my life that scares me, that's hard, that's challenging, that's depressing. And all of us are struggling in ourselves to hold those two things together, that I can be full of fear and I can be full of joy, and oftentimes in the same 5 minutes, and sometimes really at the very exact same time. That is the experience. And I think that's what we see in Jesus right here, is that he understands the joy set before him, so he endured the cross, as Paul will say it later. But at the same time, there's fear and there's anxiety that Jesus feels. And so then he says, Father, glorify your name, which I love this phrase. And what he's saying, I think this is my paraphrase, help me in what I say and what I do to bring maximum honor and glory to you. When Jesus says, Father, glorify your name, he's just saying, like, I'm going to do this. And when I do this, I want to bring maximum amount of glory to you, Father. And so then the voice from heaven that responds says, I have glorified my name and I will glorify it again. And the idea here is that throughout the 3 years, what God is saying to Jesus right now is affirming Jesus' faithfulness up to this point and then promising his presence going forward. Listen, I've done that. I've brought maximum glory to my name in what you've done so far. And I'll be with you in this as we go forward. This, as I said, the third time that we hear a voice from heaven in the Gospels. The first ones are in Matthew. And the context of what God the Father says, I think, is beautiful. And I've just looked at the time and I have to hurry. But I've said many times in here that the voice I hear, the God's voice I hear in my head, or I have heard most of my life, is one of God being eternally disappointed in me. That's my own garbage, I know. But that's just... when I think of God, I just think God is always like clucking his tongue at me, like, there he goes again. And yet what we see with God talking about Jesus, this is really beautiful, is Matthew 3, what he says when Jesus comes up out of his baptism is, I'm so proud of my son. And in Matthew 17, at the transfiguration, when we hear a voice again, he says again, I'm so proud of my son, and then adds the, and listen to him. And then this one, John tells us, he says, I've enabled and empowered my son in the past, and I'm going to continue to empower and enable him. And I was challenged this week. I got to this point, and I had to stop. Like, the voice of God in Scripture is kind and loving and gentle and full of pride and confidence in his son. And I'm supposed to follow in the pathway of Jesus there too. That maybe God looks at me and says, I'm so proud of my son. Maybe God looks at me and says, I've enabled and empowered you in the past, and I will continue to enable and empower you in the future as you go forward. Just keep your posture that of Jesus, that whatever I do, I want to bring glory to your name. The crowd that was there, and we talked about that. And then Jesus said, this voice was for your benefit, not mine. Now is time for judgment on this world. Now the prince of this world, the Greek word here is, will be exorcised, which is just really great. It's unfortunate they didn't translate that way because I love it. It's such a great word in that context. Now the prince of this world will be exorcised, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. I don't want to spend a lot of time, well, I don't have any time to spend here, but this idea of the prince of this world has been exorcised, at least in Jesus' understanding, that doesn't mean that he's absent, but that we ought not to fear anymore. There's a lot of, in some places in religious circles, there's a lot of fear of Satan. It's hard for me to say that and not think Dana Carvey. Satan? But this idea that he's been exorcised, but is still present, still influencing and tempting, and there's still this, it's the already not yet thing we've talked about many, many times before. That there is a sense in which it's finished, but it's an ongoing finishing that's happening, and we see that reflected here in Jesus. And then he says, I'll be lifted up from the earth and draw all people to myself. And then John tells us, like, he's telling them right there, like, I'm going to be crucified. And they apparently would have gotten the reference. And at least we see in verse 34, the crowd gets the reference because they say, they recognize that he's saying he's going to die because they say, like, how can you be lifted up? How can this happen? Who is this Son of Man when we know what we know about the Messiah? And again, Jesus kind of dodges. Now, this Son of Man language comes from Exodus. Not Exodus. I was thinking Ezekiel, and that's wrong too. It comes from Daniel. And it's a prophecy that has to do with the Son of Man coming in power. And so he's juxtaposing this idea of that, but then also, or they're asking that because the Son of Man comes in power, and then Jesus jumps that and gets to verse 35. And I want to spend a couple minutes here before we're done. There's a lot in this passage. I was actually going to teach this morning all the way through the end of the chapter. Are you glad I didn't? Because it's so dense. Then Jesus told them, this is to me the heart and the beauty of this whole passage. Then Jesus told them, you're going to have the light just a little while longer. And again, the Greek verb here, a better way, maybe you want to write this in your Bible, is keep on walking while you have the light, before the darkness overtakes you. Whoever walks in the dark does not know where they are going. Believe in the light while you have the light so that you may become children of the light. And when he had finished speaking, Jesus left and hid themselves from him. A couple things. This idea, just jumping in the middle, but before the darkness overtakes you, juxtapose that to the prince of this world has been exorcised. Put those two things together and understand that Jesus sees this connection between there's been a victory, a la Carmen, there's been a victory over the prince of this world, but the darkness can still overcome you. And so stay close to the light. Those two things always go together. And so to hold those two things in tension, and even in time in teaching where we go too heavily to one side or another, we're missing the pathway of Jesus. To focus too much on the prince of darkness or the dark, but then to not take that seriously enough. So there's this tension sometimes in walking between those two spaces, between, like I talk about, the two rails. There's a tension there to hold both of those as true. And this idea that Jesus has of, like, the light is going to be with you a little while longer, he's talking, I think, specifically of himself right there, that I'm with you. I'm only going to be with you a little while longer, specifically about 5 more days. So stay close to this light. And I love, and I know for some of us, this gets into all kind of hippy-dippy spiritual language here, but Jesus is the one saying it, so take it up with him, not me. But he talks about this idea of living in this place of closeness to the light. That wherever we find, and I think what Jesus is saying is not only right now, obviously it's him, stay close to the light, but then also going out of here, when he leaves, the light gets harder to find, but it's not extinguished. And so again, keep on walking close to the light. That this journey that we're on is about something about dying. It's something about dying to ourselves, and it's something about death, and it's something about suffering. But it's also something about staying close to the light. Wherever we find the light. I was telling the folks at Celebrate Recover the other night, I think that part of the challenge in our world today is, I mean, seriously, I think it's probably good for all of us if we just stopped watching the news. There's this stat that I've heard for years. Like, you know what's been happening with violent crime in America over the last 20 years? Anybody know? It's going down everywhere except on the Today Show. And there, the reporting of violent crime in America is doing what? Going up. So even though there's less of it, we're talking about it more. So be afraid and come back after the break. And so I was saying that I think part of what it means to be Christian in our world today is that we're supposed to be people of light, and we're supposed to find the light, and we're supposed to celebrate the light and hold up the light and say, hey, in the midst of all the bad stuff, this is the redemption of all things that's going on, and it's good. And we ought to be celebrating that. And not just on Easter Sunday. Although it's really easy on Easter Sunday. Because, yeah, duh. And then the twist here, and then I need to be done because I have a Sunday school class to teach. And all of you are going to walk down there and I'm not going to be there. 36, believe in the light while you have the light. And again, I just need to remind us over and over again, when John says believe here, he's not thinking a list of things. It's the follow me thing. Believe in a way that leads to action. It's follow me in the light while you have the light. And then this is my favorite part. So that you become children of the light. The light isn't out there, and it's not that. We are the light. And so wherever we go, we become that light in the world that Jesus is talking about. So we keep on walking with the light, and at the same time, we are that very light. But the idea that we bring hope to the hopeless, like that whole prayer of St. Francis thing, that's it. That is the thing. That as we stay close to the light, we become light. And I know in this room that there's often like we don't feel like light. We feel like, ugh, what do I have to offer? And yet Jesus says, as we keep following after this light, as we keep staying close to the light, as we keep staying close to Jesus, or we keep staying close to the people that we see as light, as we keep celebrating light, we actually become light ourselves. We become the source of people's renewal. We become the source of their redemption. They come to us to go full circle back to the beginning of the passage. When they need to get to Jesus, when they need to get to the real light, they come through us because we are the light. And then the phrase there, that they become children of the light. And what does God say about his child? I'm well pleased. Well pleased. And so as we stay close to the light, even in the midst of our suffering, and as we're dying to ourselves, we stay close to the light, we become the light. And as we become the light, God looks at us and says, oh, I'm so pleased. Everywhere that we bring hope to the hopeless, everywhere that we bring light, everywhere that every, it's the NT quote that I read every year at Easter, every act of goodness is not wasted. Nothing is wasted in God's economy. Everything that we do that brings light into this world, no matter how small, even if it's as simple and little as picking up my neighbor's trash can rolling around the neighborhood, every act of goodness, every act of light is not wasted, and it all comes together and all counts in God's kingdom. Let's pray. God, such a dense passage, so many things in here, and yet this theme is so beautiful in this pathway of Jesus, God, that it embraces our darkness, embraces our own death to ourselves, embraces how difficult things are, and that sometimes it's hard to find light in the middle of our brokenness, in the middle of our suffering. And yet as we keep walking close to this light, God, that promise is so big that I somehow become the light that people are seeking. And so, God, keep us in this journey. Keep us on both rails of suffering and death and the celebration of light all at the same time. In your name I pray. Amen.